Hello, everyone. I'm Hazal Aydın from Boston University, and I'm delighted to be joined by my co-hosts, Zeeshan Köker from Loyola Chicago and Sertaç Sehlikoğlu from UCL. Today, we welcome Gündüz Vassaf, an acclaimed writer, psychologist, and an intellectual whose work blends literature, philosophy, and psychology across 17 published books. Vassaf worked as a clinical psychologist and taught at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, later serving as a visiting professor in Germany and a fellow at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Vienna before turning to writing in 1987. His 1992 classic, Prisoners of Ourselves, Totalitarianism in Everyday Life, has sold over 200,000 copies, while his 2023 novel, The Painter's Rebellion, explores Caravaggio's life and themes of art and self-discovery. A champion for freedom and human rights, Vassaf founded the Istanbul Amnesty International section and has been described by Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk as the freest spirit of our prose. Hello, Gündüz Bey. We are excited to host you today.
Thank you. I should also add that I have no institutional affiliation. In fact, I'm actually happy in shunning all affiliations as such, but I feel privileged with being with the three of you with your academic affiliations as well.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we have lots of questions to ask you. Perhaps, Sertaç, would you like to start?
Yes, I would be very happy to start. Thank you again for joining us today, Gündüz Bey. I'm interested in so many questions, but let's start with the theme of the series, Imagining Turkey. And hosting you here today, I think I'd like to kind of just start with a very broad question, what it means to imagine Turkey. What does it mean to imagine Turkey? But it's, if I must kind of unpack the question a little bit, I think I'm curious both in terms of comprehending its reality, because imagining also involves a level of comprehension, and also imagining a better Turkey from your angle as an author, a best-selling author, and a researcher.
Well, what strikes me about Turkey in terms of imagination and in terms of the current state of our planet is Turkey's, or those who live in Turkey, or those who are affiliated with Turkey, but Turkey is also not an exception, is Turkey's lack of imagination. Because, I mean, the three things that seem to be confronting the planet, the main issues, which we'd all agree on, would be climate change, the threat of nuclear war, and our anxiety about AI, artificial intelligence. And if you look at the discussions in Turkey, whether it's in politics, with the political parties, or the civil society organizations, what's on the social media, you see almost no references to these topics. Even in terms of local issues, local national issues, for instance, at the moment, the peace process between the Kurds and the Turks is in the forefront. But still, in spite of that, you would see more personal issues like LGBTQ, reference to them in the social media more than to the peace process that's trying to be brokered, which is really critical in the life of the nation. So that the more things become personal and individual, our imagination is boundless, but the more of it becomes universal, our imagination is unfortunately quite constricted. But I should again underline that this is not just Turkey, but many other countries as well. But if we went to a country like Norway, for instance, I think we'd get the opposite.
In terms of?
In terms of global consciousness.
Hmm. And where do you think that's, I guess, lack of imagination is coming from, or what is like the source of that, maybe in Turkey or in other places, I guess?
I think that's a good question. We're so, I mean, it's the German expression, Gesellschaft und Gemeinde, community and society. We're more of a community in Turkey than we are a society. And the more of a community that you are, the more personal, the more individual, the more local your concerns become. It's only when they're when you feel an individual in a society, that societal issues become more common to the individuals. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, this is like we are not used to responding to the questions.
It makes me think more about, like, reflect on silence, absence, and the unsaid. Like, what I mean by silence is not just like about censorship or the things that we are not allowed to say, but it makes me ask myself, like, what kinds of silences or absences exist in the narrative of Turkey? Like, I don't know, what do you think about it?
Well, fear, obviously. Fear would have a great, great deal to do with it. And it's not just fear from the powers that be, from the government. It's also, again, fear from those close to us, because we really try to avoid very much not being one of the group. We want to be a part. Again, this brings us back to the community, the Gemeinde. We need to stick together. Five guys, for instance, in their late teens or early 20s, no females around. We would be, if we were referring to females, on the whole, it would be dehumanizing the female or objectifying it. But if there were a girl with us, then our language would completely change. And then we would be in a race to show how much we appreciate the feminist cause, perhaps. But it would be done together as a group, not as an individual. So we fear, of course, the powers that be, but we also fear falling afoul of our group, of our immediate group.
So almost like ghettoization of different social groups.
Yes, yes, yes.
That makes sense. That also speaks directly almost to Hazal's growing scholarship on, you know, comprehension, intimacy, and imagination. I immediately thought about some of the connections that you're cooking.
Exactly. And the fear within the group, though, also stems from our sense of insecurity in the country. Because if you're in a country where law and order are not to be trusted, and they change from day to day and from person to person almost, then we have to stick together because we need each other against things that we fear. So we need a doctor, we need a friend, we need a notary. The more people we know and the more people we please and not object to their opinions in informal discussions, the more we feel that we have a security network of people.
I just want to add one point, actually, to this. I don't know, Zeeshan, did you have a follow-up note at all? But I'm also thinking about when I'm interviewing with people from diverse backgrounds, diverse political inclinations, etc. And when we talk about different books, one of the things that I constantly find a need to articulate is how people have a tendency to read books that will just confirm their worldview. So they almost like try to read the books that will teach them how to articulate what they already believe or want to believe, rather than diversify their knowledge, their worldview. So it's not just about the social ghettoization, but it's also kind of almost mental security they want to cling onto. That's very, like, disturbing and interesting at the same time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, perhaps you could call this another example of affective polarization, where we decide on the basis of our feelings and confirming our opinions on that basis because it makes us feel better. Affective polarization in the sense that anyone who praises a book that I read or a person that I believe in, etc., makes me feel better, stronger, unified. But if anyone that I don't condone is praised, that doesn't help. Then that disengages me from that person. Or we've seen this very much in the example of Trump in the US, of course. I mean, this is universal. The more people have shown, the media has shown Trump to be a liar, the more his supporters back him. It's another example of affective polarization. But this is in all of us, unfortunately. I mean, the Enlightenment made us think that we were rational human beings, that the human being is rational. When we shop, when we make decisions, etc., we think of our benefits and we decide on a rational basis. Well, it seems now that it seems to be the opposite. Our choices are really based on emotional reasons. And by nudging, this is Kahneman. Is it Kahneman who got the Nobel Economic Prize some years ago about nudging? Little by little, our opinions can be influenced on an emotional basis. For instance, I like Hazal. I know that Hazal reads that book. And if I want to influence Hazal on the social media, I send some messages about the book that she likes to read. And eventually, step by step, nudging her, she will end up liking a book that originally she would have hated. But that's in all of us. And the way to avoid it, of course, is critical thinking, as we all know. How do I know? To ask ourselves the question, how do I know? Or for me to ask you and for you to ask me when I'm talking away here, okay, Gündüz, that sounds fine, but how do you know what you said is true? We have to challenge each other. Otherwise, we float along on a wave, on a blanket, on a nice blanket above the air that floats, but we don't even know why it floats above the air. And it's not collapsing to the earth.
Also, I think, I completely agree. And maybe this is like a basic point, but I guess as we grow up also, what we know becomes our identity. And maybe like radical thinking gets even more and more like difficult to engage people with, because what you know, you internalize it so much, you don't want to question it, because questioning it becomes an attack to one's personality. And so I think this is also backed up by the critique of identity politics maybe could come in, like very simplified form of identity politics, where certain knowledges are associated with certain identities, and even like a critique of a critical identity becomes like a something that challenges a group's knowledge or politics, etc.
Quite. And the worst thing, well, one of the worst things, nothing is more worse than anything else, but when you meet someone, for instance, I like red. Oh, you like red too. Well, that's wonderful. We try to agree, especially when two strangers meet on a train or on a bus or whatever. The tendency to agree, and anything we feel that may be a cause of disagreement, we avoid it. We keep on the same track for 10, 15 minutes, this first meeting in formal communication, but it happens with couples too, or potential couples. We want to agree first. We want to be agreeable. We want everyone to know that we're an agreeable person. We'll go along with everything. We're easy. Whereas, isn't it wonderful, this wonderful to have discussions and to disagree? And love each other more because we can disagree and learn from each other as a result, because we always have something to learn from each other. But if you don't challenge each other and disagree with each other, the learning process doesn't come. I mean, we have the agree, disagree in Hegel, the three, what is it? Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I mean, that's how we reach knowledge. Without Hegel, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Is that Hegel? I'm not sure.
But I think connecting a little bit further to Zeeshan's question, I'm also like, it's very fascinating that the conversation is evolving this way. One of the things that I find when people from very different political inclinations get together and don't know even how to disagree, they seem to kind of lack, because Zeeshan's question was about silences, but I'm also thinking immediately about gaps and lack, right? Mm. They seem to lack a repertoire about how to articulate and communicate through disagreements, how to articulate disagreement and communicate through them towards a productive manner. Like, one of the things that's very interesting actually for me, every time I go to Turkey and try to initiate a conversation, people even from the same family, from all the same political class, etc. backgrounds, the tendency is to say the last word and finish the conversation with a high tone. So that's a different repertoire than what we need to continue disagreement in a productive manner. I don't know if it makes sense.
It does indeed. The period, when you say the last sentence, put the period at the end of the conversation, that seems like a resolution that everybody has agreed. At least agreed to stop the conversation. So that's also a sense of agreement, rather than pursuing it, or rather acknowledging that we have disagreed.
Yeah. Even the phrase we use is kapak. It's kind of putting a lid.
Exactly.
Yes. I think has a follow-up.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you guys want to add something. Otherwise, I want to like move to a kind of a book related question I had from, I was just like reading your book. Yes. And one of the questions that like popped up in my head, I guess, it's also kind of an open
Do you want to say which book?
Prisoners of Ourselves, right? I'm reading the Turkish version, Prisoners of Ourselves.
The Turkish is
Cehenneme Övgü. So in your book, you suggest like what's truly, one of the things that you suggest, I guess, is what's truly interesting isn't this like order or orderly paradise. We're like not really necessarily interested in that, but rather like chaos, human desires, hell, however you want to like interpret it, is the most more interesting things. And you pose like this interesting, really interesting critiques to like the ways in which like bourgeois order or totalitarian order is like shaping our lives. I completely agree. But one of the things I was thinking was that today we see like different kinds of hells or disorder, from Turkey to Gaza to in many like different places. And like a stable, ordinary life has become this luxury rather than the norm itself. So while we oppose like this totalitarian orderliness, how can we reclaim our right to mundaneness? I'm like thinking about what does it mean to have a mundane life? Maybe I guess I can also ask, like, how did your perspective, did your perspective change over the years about what constitutes order and disorder, hell or paradise? Can we reclaim our right to a mundane, boring life when it has become a luxury for so many people?
Someone I met yesterday was talking about first world problems, for instance. But yes, absolutely. I mean, the struggle of the human being, in a way, from the beginning, has been to give order to chaos, to create cosmos out of chaos, of course. So we have creation theories trying to explain how we came about, and it just, we have Aristotle trying to categorize everything so that everyone has its own place, definitions, whatnot, but you're absolutely, absolutely, fortunately agree, not unfortunately agree, that at this stage in our civilization, when everything seems to be breaking up, it's very difficult for us to adjust to all this chaos, make sense of all this chaos, especially because it hurts more than hurts. It attacks our sense of ethics. It attacks our conscience. And so the question comes, what can I do? And when you feel in a way that you're almost useless, that you can't do anything, this feeling of being at a loss, then we end up not agreeing, not disagreeing, but indeed looking for what you say, a mundane way of life, which could be getting even more pleasure from washing dishes or watering the lawn or cutting your fingernails, whatever. Escape into immediate reality of ourselves and discover things in ourselves, perhaps hobbies or new authors or writing poetry, whatever. But I'm afraid that this chaos is going to increase. The entropy is going to increase. It's not going to get less, especially with AI coming in and our feeling even more insecure as to who's controlling what. It will be even more and more difficult to explain things. So to maintain our sense of health, and for us, for our conscience, very difficult, but for us to adjust to this, we have to adjust to chaos. Unfortunately, we have to say that's the way things are. But in spite of that, we will go on together in solidarity as much as possible, not a permanent sense of solidarity, not permanent relationships in solidarity, be it political parties, organizations, constitutions of nations that bring us together, whatever, but solidarity with whatever cause, whatever purpose that seem to be affecting us and that we seem to be doing something about at the moment. But this is the way now, from now on, I think. The species has entered a brand new environment. And perhaps, I mean, another characteristic of our species always has been always to be curious and ask why. Why is this happening? Why is it like that? And that's how we got the Enlightenment as well. But it will be more and more difficult to get the whys. But it shouldn't, that shouldn't prevent us from asking, what can I do?
When you mention solidarity, it's sometimes like our attempt to achieve this is sometimes like it's been silenced and forbidden, because you've been living in multiple countries and cities, right? And I moved to the US in my 20s. For me, it's a strange position to be in, as we have emotionally intensified care for a place we are no longer physically in. When I try to make sense of what's happening in Turkey, especially in the past couple of months, I feel the constant pressure of being outside. I sometimes even feel like I'm being silenced and forbidden from making a comment and to achieve a solidarity with the people in Turkey. And it makes me question myself, am I truly understanding this? Am I truly perceiving it the way someone in Turkey would? Is this what we call critical distance, or is it something else? I know, like, I just wonder like how they interpret the kind of perception we develop when we are outside of Turkey, but still deeply invested in it. Like, how do you think this has changed the way we imagine Turkey's future, maybe?
I remember having that sense of feeling, this more or less the same sense of feeling, spending some of my teenage years in the US. And when I went back, I felt like such a stranger that, and it was until one day when I was living in Ankara, I had to go to Istanbul. I needed some money. I didn't have enough for the trip, but all my clothing was from the US. So I went to Hergele Meydan in Ankara, where you can buy used everything. And I bargained so hard about the price of my trousers and shoes that I wanted to sell. that one of the buyers asked me if I had a store or if I went around from shop to shop selling things. And I felt so good with that question. I said, now I finally belong. But now looking back on it, of course, much later, the sense of belonging is just the opposite. It's exactly what we should avoid, I think. Again, another anecdote. Once in an interview, someone asked me why I lived in Istanbul. I'd never asked that question to myself, and that was when I was more or less living in Istanbul. And as the sort of the answer was coming from my brain through my lips, I said, God, I said, I hope it's not out of habit. Because if I'm living in Istanbul out of habit, that means I don't give a damn about Istanbul. I don't care about it anymore. Because when things become habit, it's like being on automatic pilot, whether it's with your partner or where you live, the language you speak, your religion, whatever. So I think that's a very positive feeling now reflecting on it to my past, what you're saying. It's good that you don't belong because you have a lot more to contribute and a lot more to understand. And if you can expressly say that, look, I'm different, and it's because I'm different, because I see things differently, that it makes for a greater whole in comprehending our situation in Turkey, in that particular locality or situation. The ugly duckling is the story of the ugly duckling. It's of the ugly duckling, right? Here comes the most beautiful duck.
It's a good one.
I want to add like kind of a question or a comment. I don't know what it is yet, but about your like comment on the sense of belonging and that we should avoid that sense of belonging. I guess I understand what you mean, but I also think there's like a battle between different groups, and like maybe a lot of political battles we have in Turkey is about like one group denying belonging to another group, I think. And like the peace process is, I think, is an extension of that, like how the current like authoritarian government is like denying belonging to so many different groups, not just one group is also part of that. Yeah, I guess maybe how can we balance that sense of like unquestioned belonging and denying others belonging versus the struggle to belong, or like the right to belong, the right to feel belonging to a land, to a place that you grew up in. What would you say about that?
Universal principles. I mean, before the Kurdish-Turkish issues, very simple elements, very simple parts to it. The right to speak your mother tongue. If we all believe in that, then the rest becomes easier. But if the addendum to that is yes, but if they speak their mother tongue, then they will not be Turks, which means they'll be a danger to our society. That takes the argument away from universal principles. First, we have to agree on universal principles, or principles that we believe are universal. But then we can come to the second stage. So, but we immediately jump into the differences of the issue, the implications of the issue for realpolitik, which could change from day to day. And they do change from day to day. For instance, during World War II, the Soviets, communism, the Germans, fascism, were enemies. And then one day, everybody woke up to read that Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, and Ribbentrop, Hitler's foreign minister, met, signed a piece of paper, aggression pact. They became friends in one day. But so things can change from day to day. But if you judge your opinions on your sense of belonging, if that sort of determines the way, then you lose all principles. You lose all conscience.
I always find it, on top of that, I always find it very unhealthy and a good route for toxicity overall when we locate critical angle with love And that's not necessarily the case. That's never the case. We do care, and that's why we are critical. And any tendency to silence any critical angle by claiming it lacks care or a position or represents a position of oppositionality or like some enemy position, then it weakens all the possibilities in furthering conversation.
Thank you, Sartaj. Thank you for that. That reminds me once again. Someone asked me, I think, why I lived in Turkey, or why I went on keeping going back to Turkey. And I said, it's the place where I swear the most, because that means that that's the place that I care for the most, that I love the most. I mean, when I go to Norway, I'm sure there are terrible things in Norway, but I just, as an outsider, I only see initially what I appreciate. But I'm sure if I'd lived in Norway for a year, I would have noticed things that needed to be criticized for there to be a better Norway.
Yeah, critique can come from love, not animosity.
Exactly. We criticize because we love, we care. Exactly. Thank you for that.
This conversation is getting tastier and tastier, but we do have a wrap-up point, and I have a burning question. I don't want to miss the opportunity of asking a question like this at a platform that's titled Imagining Turkey to an author that's like literally best-selling in Turkey. And obviously, we are all academics, all three of us. So the way you connect to Turkish public is, or Turkey with your intellectual enthusiasm is very different than ours. So my question, I think, is like one of your goals as a best-selling author is, of course, to address the public and public comprehension, and in a particular manner, right? You also constantly want to push the public towards an action. So I think I'm interested in the way you maneuver your authorship when you are establishing yourself, you are connecting to the public comprehension. Like a very general question, but something really burning inside of me.
I don't know if I can... Well, let's try to dance, see what I come up with. I mean, whatever and whenever I write, first of all, I don't plan in advance what I'm going to write. That is, almost none of the books that I've written have started with the idea that I want to write a book, and the book will be about this, and the outline will be this, etc. It just really comes. So everything that really, what I write about, I think is personal. And it's what's on my mind at the moment, what upsets me at the moment, what I'd like to inquire about myself or about the world at the moment. And then the rest comes. While writing it, I think of nobody else reading it. That means that I have to let the thing rest for a while, sometimes a month and another 2 months, sometimes a year, so that I can always look at it as an outsider. And to the degree, it sometimes happens, but then you've got your ego trip because you want it published as soon as possible. But if I can come to the stage where I ask myself, did I write that? Then that means that I've alienated myself to the degree that I can be critical of it. But it takes time, of course. I don't know if that's... I don't know if we're sort of embracing each other in a dance with this or not.
But also, like, kind of, do you think about when you are envisioning your audience, do you think about how to put them into action? You know, the kind of how Socrates talks about him being a fly, you know, and Athens being a lazy old horse, and like, kind of, like, how, like, because your writing is really designed to question, like to make people question things. I'm also, I think, a little bit interested in that very micro moment.
No, I think I'm writing to myself at the same time as I'm writing, because these are issues that hurt me. And I'm not writing things to enlighten, explain, criticize, provoke, make other people happy, to entertain them, whatever. It's just really a struggle with myself. But I'm no different than anybody else. I think Oruç Aroba,
yes,
philosopher, writer. I think I agreed with him in one of his comments I wrote about one of my books. He said he writes everything. Gündüz writes everything that we know. But it's at the tip of our tongues, and it just hasn't come out. What he writes is what's at the tip of our tongues. Maybe that's sort of
So it's almost like the sharing the fragility of the author himself.
Yeah. Maybe. So thank you, Orit, for that.
Thank you.
And Gündüz Bey, thank you so much for joining us today and for accepting our invitation. It's been a real pleasure to host you on Imagining Turkey. And we are deeply grateful for your time, your reflections, and the generosity with which you shared your thoughts. It means a lot to us that you joined this conversation as we continue to explore how Turkey is imagined, narrated, and felt, both from within and beyond its borders. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.